I've already had a student who lost her apnea because he was late to every meeting with the Board of Trustees, and Balabatan don't take kindly to people who wander in late. Today is Sunday, December 4th, 2011, and I want to welcome the students in front of me, and I want to say hello to all those listening across the expanse of the great universe. I want to thank you. I appreciate the correspondence. I just apologize. I don't have a secretary, so it's very hard for me to answer everything individually, although I try my best. Now, today we have fascinating material, and I just want to summarize so Yaakov, who is new, can just walk in and pick up where we're at. We're dealing with the question of interethnic marriage. We've started this not a year ago, but let's say last April, March, and we will be finishing it, I hope, by next week, Bezrat Hashem, on finishing that topic. The topic is very fascinating because if you marry an Ashkenazi, marries a Sephardic girl, so Daniel will tell you right away what happens Pesach when he doesn't eat beans and she eats beans, or the opposite, she's Ashkenazic, she doesn't and he does. And how do you work out in one house, there should be one minhag. And essentially we saw that the woman has to follow the man. That when it comes to minhag, you have to have one home, one address, one last name. And just as we have one bank account in a happy, again, I'm talking about a normal marriage. Your generation is being raised at a time that to me is not normal, but that simply makes me an old man and makes you youngsters dealing with a different reality. But we have to have one sense of identity, and the woman follows the man when it comes to minhag. Now, Rav Ovadia, and I'm picking up where we left off last week, Rav Ovadia, Steve, do you go by Steve, Stevie, or Stephen? Which is it?
Stephen.
Stephen. It's hard for me because my brother is Stevie, and I know Steve's. I've never yet called a Stephen a Stephen, but I'll try my best. Your wife calls you Stephen?
Yes.
Okay. And when she's mad at you, what does she call you?
Stephen.
Stephen. All right. Mendel, how did you get in? Where's your wife? Where are the kids? Okay. When you called Friday, you should know I was playing with the automatic elevator. It wasn't simple for my wife to get the phone to me. No, don't apologize. But just be aware that the Rebbe was busy playing with the timing of the automatic elevator. Ephraim, Yitz, okay. I can't believe it. You were able to print it out?
I have both things.
You're good? Okay. One
and
sec.
It's also the Naomi Reagan article.
Okay, 1 second. All right, 1 second. Let me go back. So we're picking up where we left off last week. And Rabbi Rubin, there's someone here, a guest, who will become a regular, who lives right in your street. So I told him after class, he won't have to wander through all of Bayit Vagan. You'll be able to give him a lift back to civilization. Okay, his name is Yaakov Slebiak. He's sitting right there. He's from Dallas, Texas. That's Rabbi Yitzchak Rubin. Gentlemen, so Rav Ovadia adds another, I would say, a curveball, that it's not just that the woman has to follow a man, but in Eretz Yisrael, where the overwhelming majority of interethnic marriages are, at least until now, although I have to say in the Mizrahi world, in our world, it's changing, it's always the Sephardic man marrying the Ashkenazic woman. And Rav Ovadia says there's a second reason she has to follow her husband, because it may very well be in the land of Israel, in the state of Israel, we all become Sephardim. And we developed this. The Beis Joseph was the posek here, the original community, coming back from the cult. I forget who was talking with me. Nachum Lamb, Friday night, was talking with me. But after all, Ashkenazim outnumbered the Sephardim ultimately. Yes, but the original community was established in the 1500s. It was Sephardic, it was Sephard, then it was Yerushalayim. The Beis Joseph was the Muradiyara of Eretz Yisrael. His tzak was accepted by everyone. If that's the case, then all of us have to become Sfatim, even if we are the majority today in numbers, which I doubt. I'll tell you why in a second. But as each group of Ashkenazim came, they were nullified and they become part of the Sfatic community. Now, why do I doubt if we're the majority today? For one simple reason, and we'll come to this next week. It's a very fascinating question. Yes, the Russian Aliyah changed the makeup of the state of Israel. You fellas don't realize what the Russian emigration, I use the word emigration now, what it meant to the state of Israel. But let me put it this way. Until 1989, anyone who came from Russia was coming in Aliyah. After 1989, the masses came. They were emigrating to a higher society, to a Western society, to a democratic society. The leftist press, and I don't have to tell you what Haaretz is, Ashoka now has been accused. He's made statements that are beyond belief, and he'll get away with it because he has endless money. And we have the problem with the Supreme Court representing Rehavia. I live in Rehavia. I'm you fellas know what's going on in the country. You're just living in an igloo. You're living in an igloo, so I don't want to waste your time. But those of you who know, Beinish said, Rehavia's become a dirty word. No, Rehavia's not a dirty word. Rakef is proud to say he lives in Rehavia. But a Supreme Court has to represent the people, not just a little neighborhood called Rehavia in Yerushalayim. So the Haaretz and secular columnists in Maariv and Yediot were rejoicing. The Russians are coming. It's going to make the country entirely secular. They were right. The Russians came with no religion whatsoever, by and large. I mean, yeah, I'm simplifying it. But if you've studied the Washington to Washington, you know that what I'm saying is not entirely true. I gave a good deal of my life, and I still do, to help bring Russians to Torah. But the country changed. Yes, secular, correct. What the leftists didn't realize was that they're very right-wing. So this presents a tremendous problem for the leftists today, for people like Dorit Beinish, etc., that there's a built-in right-wing religious majority in the country, right-wing politically and religious, and they join together and make their compromises, and for the time foreseeable, the foreseeable future, it does not look like any leftist party can form a coalition, can form a government. But it's true that the Russians are mainly Ashkenazim, but the Ashkenazim among them have no religious consciousness whatsoever, by and large. So what makes a majority? You follow what I'm saying, Daniel? You have the Sfardim, you have the Russian Bukharin and Georgians who are Sfardim to begin with and have religious consciousness. Then you have 1.5 million Russians, a third of whom are not even Jewish. Do they count in the picture? I doubt it. When there's no tradition whatsoever, you can't say they're Ashkenazim, you can't say they're Sfardim. We have to leave them as a community unto themselves as they sort themselves out. And by the way, in America today, with those advertisements, those were all Russians that put those advertisements in. The Ministry of Aliyah is in the hands of the Russians. And that's like a Russian mentality, to be very brutal, very forthright. And you see what happened. Bibi, of course, caved in immediately and knocked out the advertisements because the American Jews are screaming, Kaiva Kayim, and read the newspapers. To go into detail would take too long. Yes, Yitzchak.
I want to know if I did the right thing. I didn't do the right thing. In teaching converts,
yeah,
I told them they're the only ones who can now choose whether, not only what their name will be, they can choose whether they're going to have Minhag Ashkenazim and
Nazar. What you're saying is open to discussion, because if they're Ashkenazim in their blood, how do you give them a right?
They're Goyim.
You're absolutely right. But I don't think they can choose. I think in Eretz Yisrael they have to become Sfatim. I think Rav Avadja is right. I think you've been too generous. Right. Right, Kitna, all right, you turned out hybrids, but I'm going to deal with that next week. But I want to give you a shakaru from Rav Avadja. So look at Rav Avadja. We saw the Chuvat last week. First he began, I quoted to you from the Chazon Avadja, that a woman can become a Sfardi, she's married to a Sfardi, she's now a Sfardiya, even though she's Ashkenaziya, But she has to be Mataneda. Remember we said that 2 weeks ago? That she has to be Mataneda on what she did until now. Then I showed you the Abiyah Omer Chelik Hamishi, that the woman no longer has to be Mataneda. The minute she marries an Ashkenazi, a Sfardi, she is a Sfardiya. Now, remember I introduced you to Rav Ovadia, that in back of every major volume of Yabia Omer, which is his main literary output, in back of every volume he has addendums and additions. If you look into Yabia Omer, Chelik 5, Siman, an addition to Siman Lamed Zion, and it's on page Shin Nun Hey, and it is unbelievable what he says here. And let me quote it, and let's just analyze it for a minute. It's an addendum. If you look at the regular trivia, you're going to miss this. If you catch the addendum, and it's so important to be able to realize their addendums. You see, Reb Moshe doesn't have addendums, but what Reb Moshe does is in later volumes, he refers back to earlier volumes. And in order to really deal with Reb Moshe, you have to have an index and know the progression of when he dealt with the same topic in Volume 1, in Volume 3, in Volume 5, in Volume 7. Now they came out with a Volume 9. You have to be able to see it as an overlook. Chaim, this is what Rav Ovadia says, that an Ashkenaziyah married to a Sfardi, and in her father's house she had all the chumrat of not eating legumes. So when she marries, she absolutely has to follow her husband. What about the opposite? When a Sfardiyah marries an Ashkenazi and her husband doesn't eat legumes? So Rav Ovadia says he can't bring himself to say she's forbidden to eat legumes, you understand? Because Rav Ovadia, he knows it's permissible. She's a Sfardiya. But he advises her that don't cook legumes in your house. Don't upset your husband. Don't create machloket. But when you go back to your father's house, Wow. Listen to what he says, that in Eretz Yisrael, even though she married an Ashkenazi, but it's just shalom bayit. Me'ika hadin, a Sfardiyah remains a Sfardiyah. We're all b'nei Eidot HaMizrach. And she, in her house, shalom bayit, fine. Don't bring in beans on Pesach. You go back to your father's house, you eat like a queen, whatever your father and mother served you. Now just think about this. You understand? First he said she has to be Mataneda, you understand, when Ashkenaziyah. Then he said the Ashkenaziyah doesn't need any Hatarit Nadarim, she's married to a Sfardi and it's Eretz Yisrael. And now, with the poor Sfardiyah married to an Ashkenazi, all right, shalom bayit, don't upset your husband. You go back to your parents, you eat with them. No, what do you do? For the sake of argument, you're an Ashkenazi. You go back to your in-laws on Pesach. There's your wife stuffing herself, rice, beans, legumes. What do you do? Now, there may be another factor here too. And having lived in Israel 42 plus years, I have seen this factor at work. Sfardim have much greater concept of family. much greater concept of kibud avyein could also be that this this figures into Rav Avanch's reasoning that an Ashkenazic father, let him go fly a kite. He doesn't like my minhagim. This is my husband. This is what I do. Take it or leave it. I'm married. Goodbye. I've had therapy. I don't have to tell you a therapist. I've seen therapy too many times. I know exactly how the therapists handle it and what they tell you. They may be right. I'm not saying, but you know, you're married. You have to tell your parents off. Don't let them interfere. All right, I have a different approach, but I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a therapist. I would never advise that. I would advise you have to sit, you have to talk, you have to explain your husband. You don't want to offend your parents. But the Sfadim, their inheritance for their parents is fabulous. And when the father is eating rice and he says to the daughter, what, you're not eating rice in my house? It probably becomes a chiyuv d'oraita to listen to your father. What the poor husband does, I don't know. But this is Rav Ovadia. Wow.
Is he allowed to change so by him also and eat in his father-in-law's house?
Rav Ovadia, in a moment of truth, would, in Eretz Yisrael, would probably say absolutely. But this last Pesach, I expected him to be vocal and strident. But I think Rav Yosef was breathing down his back, if you know the inner relationship there. So he said, So I heard it, you know, and I heard his son speak. Dafka, the one who speaks on the radio in Kol Chai, I know him very well from the army. He's a tremendous talent. He's a fine Talmud Chacham. And he actually was a Rav Tzvayi for many years. He was the Rav Chil Avi, if I recall. In my time, I lectured for him a number of times. I lectured for people he brought in to the Mate Klali. So, and then Rav Ovadia adds on that she's married to an Ashkenazi and I don't know what he means by this. I hate to think if it's the simple interpretation of these words. Umikol shekin, sheinu reshoit lakeh lachomi basak hasheh, sheinu nakeh meisir chot hareya, in parentheses, glat, ukiyotze bezeh, v'yein kam makom laharech, if I understand him correctly, and I think there's no other way to understand him. That chumrah, and I told you what the Rav said, and we learned Yoredeya with the Rav. So all of you know, you're learning Yoredeya. You find time and again the Rama is more machmir than the Machaber. Time and again. Right or wrong? Time and again. Yeshomrim. But one thing is for sure, he's more machmir than the Machaber. More machmir than the Beis Yosef. Ah, watch. So the Rav says, you know, the Rav had a sense of humor. So he said, the Welt macht a Tayus. The world makes a mistake. Everyone thinks the Sfadim is so mekil. He says, they have one chumrah that knocks all the kulot out of the box. And that is with meat, that they are makpir and chalak, and glat kosher, Beis Yosef Shkiter, as it's called here. And the Rav, who gave Hechshu and his Shlachtos, understood what that meant, because if you're slaughtering animals, I think, if I recall correctly, the Rav once got very angry at Satma Shkita. He yelled out in class, glat kosher, glat treif. I mean, don't take it literally, because the Rav could fly off the handle, at least when we were his Talmudim. It's before he mellowed, the 50s. And then he explained himself that, he says, a shlachtos has to have 22 to 25% of the cows have to be with shilas. Basically, many of them are not treif, others are treif. Many of them you have to do if you're going to check for sichot, but 22 to 25%. He said in the glat kosher shrita, I think he was referring to Satma, he said the percentage is less, and that cannot be, he said. And he was livid, he flew off the handle. So he said that this chumrah is a tremendous chumrah, because if you're makpid on glat, and you're makpid, and I understand the Beit Yosef glat is even more chumradic than the Hungarian glat. So he says here that this woman, chas v'chalila, she should eat regular kosher meat. Even in her husband's house, she has to buy glatt beis Yosef. Now, that's what he's saying. Think of the implications. The husband is struggling, Chaim, you think everyone is wealthy? You know, it's, you saw the New York Times with the big article on the Gemach, very fascinating. New York Times picked it up in Atlanta, Georgia. This must be a Chabadnik, has a Gemach that his father had a Gemach years ago. People are suffering today financially, you understand? So nice, good Jews have to borrow money from a Gemach for food, for basic essentials of life, Lo Aleinu. So not everyone. So could you imagine the wife comes home from Osherad? There's a tremendous supermarket. Some of you know that if you go to Osherad, everything is glatt, and you see they give you a choice: Shchitat Beis Yosef, Machpud, Shchitat Rav Rubin, DOU. I think it's called Fleisch, if I'm not mistaken. Although I understand already in the Shiva Rakotel, they asked the DOU. God, you can't. My grandson is in Yeshiva HaKotel. I said, the only thing I can think of problem with the OU is OUD. I explained to him that OUD doesn't mean Chol of Yisrael. And then a different grandson who's now going into a Baruch Hashem, a very, very unique unit. We took him out the other night to wish him well. He has to leave Hesdi. He's going in for many years. And he starts asking me, OUD. I say, why are you asking me? He says, he started a chumrah now, he only eats Chol of Yisrael. So I don't know, I must be doing something wrong or something right. You can interpret it as you wish. But could you imagine, she comes home from Osherad, the husband says, Malkala, let me see how much you spend. What's the visa? What does it look like? Oh my gosh, 3 kilo of meat, 100 shekel? I could buy the same thing in Hashikma, in Talpiyot, for 50 shekel. Ah, my darling Shlomo, I grew up in a Sephardic home. My father taught me that this is the only kashrut. Rav Ovadia talks about it, and she'll give him the sauce. But it's fabulous. Rav Ovadia doesn't skip a beat. Sephardic pride conquers all. And I don't know if you're... Do we have any case in the Kollel of an Ashkenazi married to a Sephardia? And she goes back to her father's home on Pesach, and the rice, the beans, everything is set. Okay, gentlemen, we have arrived, Rav Moshe Feinstein. Now, these two tshuvot are extremely fascinating, because it's not just the she'ela lahalacha, it captures a world. But before I go further, I want to thank my student, Dr. Alan Blau. We spoke about Rav Moshe, and he sent me sources. He evidently is a big bucky in Rav Moshe, because I know the first 5 volumes backwards and forwards, but after that I don't have that same knowledge. So he sent me from the third time Rav Moshe does Orech Chaim. First of all, remember we spoke about in class with the concept of being Mekabel Shabbos early. Does it obligate everyone in the community? What's that? The whole question among the Rishonim, is there a problem of lotit goldadu, of having two communities, etc. So we said, and I mentioned in passing, that if you makabel Shabbos early, your wife has to follow you. Now, that is the halacha that is accepted in Yerushalayim, and it's zil kri be'rafu, in the sense that it's one home, it's not two kehillah. If you and your wife are one community, it's the same thinking. So he sent me Reb Moshe Simon Lamed Chet, has a tshuva from 1963. I had a student, there was a student in Torah Tragu, who used to sit in my classes, David Deitcher. This student is to Halav David HaKohen Deitcher. And he was asked if the husband's being Makabel Shabbos obligates the wife, and Ein Hachinami, Reb Moshe Rand said no, that they're two different individuals, and even if he's davening early, he can't force his Tosfot Shabbos upon the wife. So be aware that Reb Moshe differs, although I'm not telling you halakha l'maisa, I never yet saw this. Halakha l'maisa, wherever I've been, even in a hotel, when they makabel Shabbos early, they will always announce to the women that they have to light candles early, because the minyan is being mekabel Shabbos early. But this is Reb Moshe. I just want to mention it. But the more important thing is the next thing. Yeah, go ahead. You can.
I was going to say, in the summer it happens a lot, where in America we accept early Shabbos, so a woman's working and the husband's not working, and here is an ofrof at the early minyan at 7 o'clock, and then the 8:15 minyan is the woman's not getting home until 7:30 from work or whatever.
45 at night, you're talking about.
Yeah, Friday.
So they follow Reb Moshe like
that. I think Reb Moshe is like that, but I've heard that other posts can say that.
I know, in Yerushalayim, I never yet heard anyone, even Rav Asher Weiss, who was very makehill with lichbenching, but basically when he was very makehill that you can light lich before the plug. I mean, he gave a meridik shir. I was blown away by it, because I constantly get the shayla of women who want to go to the kotel, what about lichbenching? So I tell them the best thing to do is right after the plug, light candles with the tanai that you're not really being makabel Shabbos till you get to the kotel. But the truth is, I tell them, you don't have to do any yisum malacha, because let your husband hold the door of the car for you, and you take a cab, right? So you sit down in the cab, you're not doing the malacha d'oraita. So it's a very good solution. But according to Rav Asher, you don't even have to wait for the plug. Listen, I don't have to tell you, halakha, we're going to come to it, if not this year, next year. What does it mean? An individual opinion of Shasat HaChak. These are problems you're going to have to deal with in the rabbinate today. Riverdale, which now has become a euphemism, as I'll explain tomorrow, Riverdale, you understand that they say, we have an opinion, it's our opinion, we're entitled, we're rabbis, we have a source. No, you understand what I'm saying? These are real problems. What Shasat HaChak? When can you take a dat yachid, etc., etc.? Have a world to say, but not for now. But I just want to be intellectually honest that I took it as a davar pashut, and here Reb Moshe has a different opinion. Now, in the same volume in Siman Samach Gimel, I want to say that my memory was correct. Reb Moshe talks about peanuts, and he also says that they used to give a heksha on peanut oil. And that's exactly what I said in class, that I remember distinctly. We were talking about legumes, the whole problem of Pesach. What is a legume? And a legume is not really defined. And I and Reb Moshe recalls, just as I recall, Reb Moshe doesn't write it, but as I recall, the heksha was given by Reb Beryl Levi, who was a Chabadnik. And that Enoch Inami, the Chabad tradition was that peanuts are not legumes. Today, I don't know what the story is. Is there peanut today already? Is there peanut oil would be an okay heksha? The head, I think his name is Yisachar Dunham, but I may be wrong. The head of the okay laboratories today is Rabbi Beryl Levy's son. And Beryl Levy was a very elegant individual. I don't want to go into details, but he died of Bachmas Nefesh. Because a heksha went wrong, he was misled. There was a whole shaila with Pesach. In the 70s was a big, big issue, and right afterwards he was misled, and the other kashrut organizations depended upon him, and it was a sad story, and he took it to heart. And I want to tell you, that's a sign of honesty. Many people give heksherim. I don't want to tell you. I cannot. I had a classmate. He's no longer alive. It's a heksha you can't trust. So he once mentioned to another rabbi, a good friend of mine, the real money is in the Hechsherim. I mean, this is the way a rabbi is speaking. So you can draw your own conclusions. But I believe Beryl Levy, the okay, gave a Hechsherim. Peanut oil, and Baruch Hashem, Yesham Milasmoch. In relation to legumes, I got a whole communication today with a whole shir from my Talmud, Yehoshua Grunstein, who Rav Grunstein did a whole paper on Reb Moshe and Reb Tzvi Pesach Frank, and is it a minag? Is it a gezeira? Does it apply to food that wasn't around at the time the minag began or the gezeira began? And I tell you, this is the heart of the problem. Legumes were never defined halachically. What does it mean, legumes? What about canola oil? What about sunflower oil? What about all these oils that didn't exist at the time the minhag began? And then he tries to develop that if you hold it's a gezeira, then you can use what wasn't around. If you hold it's a minhag, the minhag goes on everything that may be a legume. But what may be a legume? How do you define it? And if it's something that's in the ground, aren't potatoes legumes? And to the best of my knowledge, even the Eidah Haredit permits eating potatoes on Pesach. And Stephen, don't laugh at me. You don't know what I'm talking about. I've lived here. You know what went on with Pesach with the potato chips? That you don't know. So the Eidah Haredit, you know, when I came in Aliyah, there was none of this food in Israel. Food is very simple. But Baruch Hashem, today, you come to Israel, it's no different than America, may even be on a higher level. What's available is beyond words. So they came out with potato chips. So it had the rabbinate. They wanted to get Eidah Haredit. We're talking about the potato chips that all year have a badatz. So the Eidah Haredit, in their great wisdom, said, our grandparents didn't eat potato chips. We never heard of potato chips on Pesach. No potato chips. So all the little yingalach from the Eidah Haredit, 80% of them were sneaking behind enemy lines and buying rabbinate potato chips. Today you can't get a potato chip in Israel on Pesach that doesn't have a badatz. You understand? Money speaks. Like kefit walks, but money speaks. And think for a moment. We use potatoes. The badatz uses potatoes. It's a legend, isn't it? By definition. It's in the ground. What do you mean? So you see, there is a gezeira here. And again, I don't want to repeat myself. I went into much detail. But what's included in this gezeira, that already is minhag. And there, of course, you'll have endless machlokes. Okay, but I want to thank Rabbi Yeshua Grunstein, and I want to thank my student, Dr. Blau, Alan Blau. Very fascinating and very helpful. Now, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. And here we come to the problem of, it's an old problem. I go back to my postdoctoral research, which may be among perhaps my most fascinating published work. I actually won a commendation, call it what you wish, in the late 60s. I told you the story when I got my doctorate. So they eat your heart out, the professors, and they said to me, "It's the end of any scholarship you'll do. You're a rabbi. You waste your time in the rabbinate." And they gave me a big dig. Anyway, within a year after my doctorate, I did postdoctoral research on the Ribaz in Chicago. And it's a very fascinating topic. The city of Chicago, 1902, brings to Chicago one of the greatest gedolim to ever set foot in America, Rabbi Yaakov David Ben Zev Volovsky, known as the Ribaz, the acronym of his name, Skutzka Rav. He had published the Yerushalmi, you had it in the Beis Medrash, with a commentary he wrote like Rashi, a commentary like Tosfot. He needed money to pay the printer, and he was willing to come to America. Okay, he goes to America, and he writes for him, and he writes introductions, he writes about America. He had to run away from America 2-3 years later. I told you, it's an anecdote. Endless people have asked me whether it's true or not. I believe it's true. I heard it from the family. He came to the slaughterhouse Friday afternoon to check what's going on. They locked him into the freezer, the mafia, and they wanted him to die. They didn't have the guts to kill him, but he would die in the freezer. He finally got out Friday night, got his family, went to the railroad station on Shabbos, took the train to New York, Pikuach Nefesh. It's not a happy story. From New York, he goes to Aliyah, and he becomes the Rebbe of Tzvat. And you know him as the Baal Plukta with Rav Kook on the Chet HaMechira for Shviat. That's how you know the Ribaz, okay? And not to be confused with the Rabaz, Rav David Ibn Zimra, who was the last Achron, the last Rishon, or the first Achron. You follow me? You understand, Moshe, what I'm saying? People confuse the two. So the Ribaz wrote introductions, and he said about America, what's the problem with America? Everyone comes from a different city. No one knows each other. Now, there's a lot of truth to this. Now, it may not be so true today. Today, you come from communities, you understand. You come from Lawrence, you come from Teaneck, you come from Dallas, you come from Houston, you come from Los Angeles, you come from Toronto. Today, we have established communities. But before, 100 years, 110 years ago, 120 years ago, and after World War II, masses of people poured in from every community under the world. No one knew anybody else. And I remember in Bnei Akiva, there was one person who's no longer alive. I don't want to mention his name. A very prominent family, and his wife should live and be well. And he always said, refer to me as Rabbi Doctor. So they would say to him, Where's your smicha? Where's your doctorate? But let's see the degrees. No, no, they were lost in the Holocaust. You understand, Luke? Go argue with that. You can't argue. So you see, with the ingathering of the exiles, you have minhag versus minhag, halacha versus halacha. People who never would speak to each other in Europe. One was a likvat, one was a chassid. Each one, there were so many subdivisions, a belzer, a gera, a munkacha, an alexandra, a chutkaba. You understand? These people never spoke to each other. Suddenly in America, everyone is a neighbor. And here you come to Reb Moshe Feinstein, Igret Moshe, Orech Chaim. This is the first volume. The first time Reb Moshe does Orech Chaim. This volume is from 1959. I remember when it came out, it was the first volume. I remember we were dancing in the streets with joy that Reb Moshe is available in print. And then I remember we asked Rebbe after class, what was it, Reb Moshe's cousin? And the Rebbe was very upset. He was very, remember what he was upset with? That Reb Moshe asked liquid soap on Shabbos. And the Rav, the Rav, you know, critiqued him. And on that Shiva, I don't know, he was so upset, it's like it ruined the whole Sefer for him. But we were dancing on the streets. We have Reb Moshe in print. Siman Kuf Nun Chet. It's written, again, you know, I don't know who these people are. You know, on the Chatam Sefer, I believe also another Yehuda, they did scholarship on everyone that they sent Shiva to. You can look up, more or less, everyone they identify, because it's important to know who Reb Moshe is writing to. The Shiva is from 1955. It's the someone named Yaakov Michael Jacobs. He was a Rav. It says, Yididi Harav HaNichbad Malatu Kvodo HaRav Reb Yaakov Michael Jacobs Shlita. And he's talking about a husband and wife that have different minhagim. What do they do? And he's talking, you know, the reality. After the Holocaust, the DP camps, people were shattered. I can tell you one story. I don't want to mention names, but there was this mismach of YU, out of what you call YU, out of the 1920s, a Yiddish tzaddik. And he went into business and became quite wealthy, devoted all his time to charity, came an aliyah, unbelievable individual. So his son married a Chassidic Rebbe's daughter, Chassidic Rebbe, who also wound up in the United States running away from Hitler, I believe in the late 30s or mid 30s, running away from what was going on in Europe. So at the wedding, the Chassidic Rebbe said to the YU Musmach, my mechutna, I'm saying it in English, he said it in Yiddish, you should know, in Europe, our children would have never married. And the YU Musmach was so offended, till the day he died, he would repeat the story with anger. But these are people, you know, the Rebbe shouldn't have said it, but he didn't mean it. He meant it's a fact. In Europe, a Hasidish Rebbe from the Rushina dynasty doesn't allow his daughter to marry a YU graduate. Whoever heard of such a thing? Let it be. So now the question comes up in New York. DP camp, people married, people, by the way, many of them who recovered worked out very nice marriages. I've taught many second and third generation from these marriages. So for the sake of argument, Ungarisha married a Chassidisha married a Litvisha. I know one case where a Litvisha, a real Litvisha from Mir, winds up marrying from Mir and Slabodka, winds up marrying a Chabadnik, I mean a Chabadnikit. And ultimately, he becomes a Chabadnik himself. It's interesting, it's not that the woman converts, but he winds up converting, in quotes. Now, so again, Reb Moshe deals with the question, who do you follow? Two different minhagim. And Reb Moshe says, like all the poskim, marriage means the woman enters the husband's world. The woman goes into the husband's world. It's like what we've spoken about so many times. It's moving from one country to another country, one city to another city. Every city has its own minhagim. A woman is marrying into her husband's house, and therefore everything she does has to be like the husband religiously, because it has to be one home, not two. Fine. And Rav Moshe says, paraphrasing the Gemara in Psachim, that getting married, the Gemara in Psachim talks about going from one mimakum lemakum, going from one place to another. And Rav Moshe says, when we go from one place to another, we at times can leave, we at times can change. But a woman getting married, this is permanent, this is concrete. In her mind, this is not going to change. She's leaving Beit Aviha. She's going to the bayit of her husband, and this is permanent. Now, it's interesting. Could we say this today? Just think for a minute. Divorce, what is the statistic? I don't know. My daughter tells me in Israel, one out of three married couples get divorced. It probably is less among religious people. In America, I'm not certain it's less than one out of three. I know that in my final tailspin teaching on a collegiate level 10 years ago or more already, I know that in Midrashit Moria, I was running one out of four girls were from divorced homes. And I asked around. They told me in Michalaz the same thing, in Machon Gold is the same thing. I couldn't believe it. And you know, you carry baggage. It's not simple, you walk away, marriage. You carry baggage. It's a mother, it's a father. You all recall that before Yom Kippur. Remember what I was boasting about? That I got my Talmud in Florida to give a get. That was my boast before Yom Kippur. No? I'll convey to Aaron Rakefid, if that's what he can boast about that. Yet, on the other hand, it was a great achievement. The guy later, he wrote a letter to the Rav Masada de Get. He sent me a copy. I couldn't hold it in my hand. It was so bitter. It's like he spat in his face, with reason. And he says, the only reason I gave a get is because my Rebbe in Jerusalem said I have to, and if not, I'm making a Chil Hashem. So he gave a get. So, but most normal people, you guys are married. I would like to believe that when you got married, that your wives and you know, it's permanent. We're getting into a serious relationship. We're going to work it out. We're going to learn compromise. We're going to listen to Rakefet Shayurim. He gave a whole year in the Kollel on how to work out a happy marriage. Look, check it out. Look it up. It's on the books, as they say. So Rav Moshe says that not only does she follow her husband's menhagim, but there's no need for hatarat nedarim. He totally agrees with Rav Ovadia Yosef, although this is written long before Rav Ovadia, but Rav Ovadia's second opinion, his later opinion, that there's no need for hatarat nedarim. And he says, after all, in New York today, he says, Chapon, New York, he says we have 100 different communities. And if we're going to start trying that to insist that each one keep their community, we're never going to have shalom bias. It's going to be endless machloket. Intermarriage, interethnic marriage is all over. And we have to have one minhag in the house. And Rav Moshe Paskins 100% that it has to be like the husband. Okay. That's what he paskens. Does he remain true to it? Does he remain true to it? We have here the classic tshuva that if you wrote it for a Hollywood movie, people would be overwhelmed. What an ingenious mind. And here you have it. Gentlemen, women, hair covering. Nope. I grew up in Yeshiva University. In my time, most of my rabbeim, I have to say, their wives did not cover their hair, certainly in their homes. Absolutely not. Even in public, I'm not certain they covered their hair. I know one very important Rebbetzin would sit in the Mendel Gottesman library reading Yiddish books that she would take out while her husband, the Gadol Hador, was giving Sheyurim. Rav Yeruchim Yerelik would walk into the library, and he wouldn't fight with her over the fact that her hair was not covered. He would fight with her that she's reading Haskalah Yiddish literature. And you understand? And I still remember Dr. Belkin, Rav Shmuel Belkin. Again, these are names that breaks my heart. Dor Halech V'Dabar, and you don't even know who I'm talking about. Rav Shmuel Belkin was the greatest Baal Chesed you can imagine. His story is legendary. Why there's no doctorate on him, Rakefet has tried and tried and tried. I've gotten absolutely nowhere, and I see I'm going to get nowhere, and it's very sad for me, because he deserves to be perpetuated. What he did in organizing Stern College, what he did in organizing Einstein Medical School, you have no idea. He single-handedly made the quotas out of every medical school in the United States. And today, every second young man is a medical doctor. You all know that. My students that I taught in the 60s, the 70s, at least half of them are medical doctors. Some of them are outstanding. And later, they all go into money and banking, and today they're impoverished. They're running away from what's going on. You got to be honest. We owe the man, but he was a tremendous Baal Chesed. He organized the Kollel. People write to me, they ask me about this coffee, I was hearing that Rabbi Lichtenstein talks about it in Mevakshei Panecha, so I give them the facts. After World War II, you had Yeshiva Light, who had no panasa, and they didn't speak English yet. They didn't know what baseball was. So Rabbi Belkin organized the kollel for them. Rabbi Shippestein headed it, Rabbi Shippestein, and they learned, and they learned English, until a few years went by and everyone found a job and the kollel came to an end. It wasn't the kollel for the sake of a kollel. It wasn't the kollel for the graduates of YU. No kollel existed yet. But it was a kollel for the Europeisha. So you don't know what a Baal Chesed he was. I remember one time he was speaking, and this was rare because later in life he was very removed from the student body and overwhelmed, and this is part of the problem writing about him. His health deteriorated due to his personal life deteriorated due to the pressures of the budget. So one time he's speaking and a question came up, why are we different than Chaim Berlin and Taira Vidas? And I remember Rabbi Belkin saying there have always been differences, and you know, in Europe, in Lithuania, many women covered their hair, but more women didn't cover their hair, and the greatest rabbis, their wives did cover, didn't cover, and yet they lived b'shalom v'shalva. And of course, the question is, covering of hair, okay. I don't want to go into great detail, I've given many lectures, but there's no question that when people say to me, why didn't this Rebbetzin not cover her hair? I say, you're asking me about this particular Rebbetzin? Ask me about 500,000, 1 million other women in Lithuania, White Russia, Poland, who didn't cover their hair. Why didn't the rabbis yell, shout, scream? Okay, it's an open question. I have my own opinion. My opinion is very simple, that since Me'ika Hadin, it may only be the Rabbana, not the Oraita, the way the Rav learns Pshat in the Gemara, Baron Lichtenstein, once had a long talk with Rav Baron, had it Rebbe explain the Gemara in Ketuvah, I am dead, the Oraita, it turns out the Sefer Mitzvah by Rav Horowitz, I think it's Rabbi Yosef Dober Horowitz from New Haven, Big Talmud Chacham, the Rav Mitzvah, the Ma'ichat Megadoli Yisrael. In his Sefer Mitzvah, he learns the same pshat, that it doesn't mean the Oraita. It means at the time of the Torah, this was the minhag that women covered their hair b'rishut harabim, at least with something, kulta b'rosha. What that means, you can look into the Sri Deyesh. Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg has a very interesting tshuva which borders on scientific Jewish scholarship. What does it mean, kulta b'rosha? Okay. But then, when you cover your hair, wait a minute. So a woman, let's say, fine, a woman doesn't, in the house, she doesn't have to cover her hair. And came, lo shafta chayim l'chobat, the Gemara in Tuvah. It's a mitzvah chassidus, the Yerushalmi, kimchit, you know what I'm talking about, the Kohen Gadol, all the children were Kohen Gadol, and she covered her hair in the house, fine. But in the public thoroughfare? So now, let's take a look. People cover their hair, well, they wear a tichel. Tell me, what about a shaitel? you're allowed to wear a shaitel or not. And I don't have to tell you. Jacqueline Shaitels, you see their book advertising. It's pornography, plain and simple. You look what goes on and what people spend on shaitels. It's worse than pornography, okay? All right, my counselors of pornography are very conservative, I will admit. But you understand what I'm saying. And now let's go a step further. So then you have, there's a certain rabbi, he's no longer alive. You know the rabbi. He was rabbi in the Boston area. He wrote a book, Echo of the Nightingale. He is so bitter against Israel. And I had to find out what happened to him. What happened? So I found out his daughter went back, Meir Sharim, the works, went back in time, went back to the way her great-great-grandparents lived. And now you come, of course, I don't know if all the Satma, but the Satma, Rebarala, the women shave their hair. You think you have a frum wife because she wears a tichel and she doesn't wear a shaitel. And what about the women who shave their hair? And then they put on a shaitel, and on top of the shaitel they put on a kerchief. You understand what I'm saying? These are meisim b'chol yom. No. Now, what happens in America? You have all these different minhagim. And Nebuchadnezzar, you have a woman raised in Satma, raised on Tzniut. I mean, you have to appreciate this. And this woman was raised, Anun Garisha, that Chas V'Chalila, she shouldn't cut her hair. And her husband, you know, he insists she has to cut her hair. And he won't tolerate her not cutting her hair. And here you have a very personal matter. It's not eating beans, it's not cooking beans on Pesach. It's not the type of meat you buy, glad kosher, not glad kosher. Here is a personal matter. It's like wearing a kippah. There's so many different kippot in the world. All right, there's a kippah srugah, and there's a black kippah, and there's a black knitted kippah, and there's a gerah. You don't know, I was once in a store, Meir Sharim, where they sell kippot. I was buying kippot for my grandchildren, a little kippot, and I saw this chassid, he looking in the mirror, he's looking, he has to see that it pops up properly, that he looks like a gerah. He's a gerah chassid. And he explained to me that this is the type of kippah we wear in ger, it's a little different. Ah, Baruch Hashem. It's a very personal matter. Can your wife interfere and tell you, I don't like this kippah, I like that kippah, take off this kippah? It's a very personal matter. You talk about tichels and shaitels. Can they interfere? And I have to tell you, tremendous battles were fought here in Israel. I got a question. I may come to it afterwards. I got a beautiful letter from Chabad. And among other things, they want to know how I have a positive feeling at times of Rav Shach. And so I'll read it to you if we have time. But I want to tell you, another reason I respect Rav Shach is suddenly they started the Sheik Lacharasa. And all over Yerushalayim, Paskvilim went up against Shaitels and Shaitels and what went on here. And it didn't help. Rav Shach refused the sign. So they asked Rav Shach, why do you refuse the sign? And he said, Ich hab gesehen the Chafetz Chaim's Frau, sie ist gegangen mit der Shekel. He saw the Chafetz Chaim's Rebbetzin, she wore a Shekel. And he refused the sign. I got to give him credit, man of principle. But how do you do? What do you do? A couple. And this is a very interesting, who Rav Moshe wrote this to. They claimed that was totally untrue. That afterwards, when the hair that was cut off, that went, they had some, but that hair never reached the shaitel makers, you understand? From what I understand, the people who burned their shaitels, it was just the loss of money. That's what I understand. But I didn't research it because mir geht das nicht an in Leben. My wife, my daughters all own shaitels and they never wear it. My wife maybe once in a great while once in a great while, but they all cover their hair, they all wear tichels, they're all better than their father, than their husband, because in my life I saw the finest rebbetzins and their hair was not covered. So I do get upset if a student of mine, female students that I taught in the Chalan, the 70s, the early 80s, and they don't cover their hair, I get a little upset. Why? So they'll say, but Rebbe, your generation, this rebbetzin didn't cover, and that rebbetzin didn't cover, and I don't want to give a list. I can tell you the greatest names, names that we mentioned in class today. Their wives didn't cover their hair when they came to America. Later, some of them started, there was one, it's a well-known story, there was a yeshiva of Baltimore. His wife was the last one to cover her hair, the early 70s. So the Talmidim, you know, sarcastic, and she came from the biggest yichus. So the sarcastic Talmidim, the cynical Talmidim said, yeah, the Rosh Yeshiva's wife finally covers her hair when it's falling out. You follow? And they were right. She was an old lady already, her hair, like my hair. I need a toupee. Rebbeinu Shel Olam. My wife says to me occasionally, why don't you get a toupee? Why don't you have a... I have a devotee who had a hair transplant. I mean, I can't... Baruch Hashem. I waited a long time to see my hair fall out. Thank God I saw it fall out. I can still laugh and can still teach. Baruch Hashem. And the Modal HaKadosh Baruch Hu. This tshuva was written in 1957. It's also interesting who he wrote it to. He wrote it to the chief rabbi of St. Louis, Rav Menachem Tzvi Eichenstein. The chief rabbi just died, Rabbi Rifkin, just died. A few weeks ago, it's not more than a few weeks ago, maybe it's 2 months already, was very ill, Rabbi Rifkin. He was a son of the Torah V'Das Rosh Yeshiva, big Talmud Chacham. And Rav Eichenstein, this is a famous family it's Siddish, and the Eichensteins from Chicago. It's all part of the same family. It's two brothers. One wound up in St. Louis, and one wound up in Chicago. And I believe that Reb Moshe Meiselman is married to an Eichenstein. If I'm not mistaken, his wife's maiden name is Eichenstein. It's all part of this family. So the chief, and he was in St. Louis, there's an organized tehillah, and he was called chief rabbi. It doesn't mean he was chief rabbi of the whole city, but of this organized tehillah, which had a number of subdivisions, including Tashrit, etc., he was the chief rabbi. And what's the shaila that...
Where is the shaila?
Oh, I didn't say it's in Igrot Moshe, the first. Oh, you're right, I didn't say Igrot Moshe, Ebenezer, Siman Nun Tet. Let me just see if. Here. It's the first. No, let me be sure. Ebenezer, Siman. I hope this is the first time that Reb Moshe dealt with Ebenezer, because I see that it says 1974, and that would mean it's the second printing. It's not the first printing, because Ebenezer came out many years earlier. But my recollection is that this is Ebenezer, Chelek Aleph Ebenezer, Siman Nun Tet. And what's the shaila? That a woman who came from a community where the women all shaved off their hair, and she married a man that comes from a community where women don't shave off their hair. And all they do in his community, they wear a tichel, and the husband under no condition wants her to shave off her hair. And the woman is caught in a quagmire. She was raised, she was educated. The school she went to, for the sake of argument, let's say it's a Satma school, a Munkacha school, she was taught, you heard me, Al Yava, that if you don't shave off your hair, you're a prutza, I don't like to use that word, but it comes up in this tshuva, and you're not decorous, and you're not sneerstick, and the husband is makpid, and she's caught between the frying pan and the fire. On one hand, she's married, and her husband is yelling and shouting, and on the other hand, she was raised a certain way, and her conscience troubles her. So of course, Reb Moshe goes in that when you go from makom to makom, it's the Gemara we referred to last week in Chulin, it's Dafka Gemara, that the other day I actually was learning it. It was at the start of Kol Nidre. It's much later on in Kol Nidre. It's the famous case that Rab Zera, when he came to he moved to a different community where they ate the mugremet the Rav Vishmuel. And what does it mean? As I explained to you, the shchita, that the shchita was done at a lower part of the neck of the animal. And according to some Amorayim, it's not a good shchita, it's an avela. According to other Amorayim, it's a good shchita. And he came to a place where they do eat it. He immediately started to eat because he's now part of a new community. And when you come to a new community, you have to follow. Then you not only lechumra, but you have the right lekula. And he says, this is halacha lemaisa. And he quotes, you'll see the source there, Magen Avraham, quoting the Ram al Shaka, the with women. The whole question of a braid and women leaving part of their hair out of the tichel.
And
this Gemara in Chulin, does he get Daf Yud Chet, is the first place that is in Chulin, but it's a number of places in Chulin. When you go to Daf Yud Chet, you'll see in the Masorah Tashas the other references, because it becomes a byword. It becomes a mamish, it's a catchword, it's a rubric. It means when you go to a place and you're living there, you have to be machmir like them, and you can be makir like them.
Yeah,
and
before you mentioned the Gemara Misachim on the Zalbazach.
The Gemara Misachim is with traveling Erev Shabbos. That's the source of everything. Makam la makam. Nun Aleph, Nun Bet. It's a whole perek. Makam Shenahagu. It's a whole perek in Misachim. So here it's talking about smatan, braids. What it means about braids is leaving hair out of the tichel. You'll see this a lot of times. A woman wears a tichel. What about the hair back here? So you'll see it's taloi. Many women, you'll see that the tichel will not cover the back of the head. You'll see other women, and if you saw Yediot on Erev Shabbos, and boy, it's worth seeing it. There's an article on Rabbi Dr. Professor David Hartman, the Duby Hartman whom Rakefet writes about in Washington. And Duby just turned 80, and they interview him. And it's just unbelievable to compare where he is in life and Rabban Lichtenstein, who will soon be 80, where Rabbarin, what he did with his life. And Duvi, the Lakewood, the Chaim Berlin boy, the Lakewood boy, and then he comes to study with the Rav, and he says, it's the headline, I couldn't believe he would say this. At times he wants to commit suicide, because he sees what the Charedim and the Chadalim have done to Torah. I couldn't believe it. Wow. And what an interview, you understand? He has an I found in life, you have to have an organization behind you. I found, I don't want to mention why I'm saying this now, but it's not important. But I know no one gives a hoot about Rakefet things, because I have no, I'm just an individual. I'm Rakefet. That's it. Nothing else. YU doesn't know I exist. Besides that, the OU did me a tremendous chesed. They published my book. They didn't redo some of my other works. I'm very in debt to them, and I have to thank them from the bottom of my heart, because I'm not a, what do I do for the OU? I don't give hashgacha, I don't give this, I don't do that, I don't live in America, I'm not a rabbi of a shul. You understand what was, but thank God. But David Hartman has an institution, they interview him, and wow, you got to see that interview. But I thought to myself that some of the Charedim, you'll see the Chadalim. You know what Chadalim means? Teaching you a new Hebrew word. Charedim datiyim le'umiyim. Chardalim. Chadalim. Mustard. It's a play on the word. It's now accepted. It's not a pejorative word. That's a descriptive term. So the Chadalim, and you'll see some of the women, they have a tichel here, and they have something here as well. You understand? They cover everything like a satma. like a Haredi. I have different complaints, but that doesn't bother me so much. I'm concerned. I have different complaints. But David Hartman, it's unbelievable. But that you find, you'll see the sources in Reb Moshe, that you can't, the women depends where they're living. In some communities, they totally cover the braids coming in back of the hair and the hair in back. In other communities, they don't cover the hair in back. And a woman has a right to follow the custom of the community in which she is living. Now, Danny goes into America.
And what about this husband and wife?
One second, we'll get there, relax. Then he goes into America, and Reb Moshe says, you remember, Reb Moshe came to America the year I was born, 1937. So you got to understand what was happening in America. All these different communities, how many of you descend from people who came to America before 1930, let's say? How many descend from before? How many are after 1930? How many? So you see, the class, where are you, Michael? Where do you fit in?
What?
That's when your family came? Oh my gosh, you're a greenhorn. Wow. How did your parents, where did they survive? Grandparents?
From Vilna and one from Czechoslovakia.
Wow. I'm from Vilna too. I have one grandfather. Right, read Washington. That's the grandfather went to Valencia.
Hungary.
No, it's okay. From Hungary, it's good.
My father had a Czech
master. Your father had a... You're an Ungarische. Cut it out. Good to be Hungarian.
Too.
Right, okay. That's the heart of Hungary. I have Yichus, become Hungarian Yichus. Wunstorfer is my granddaughter-in-law. Anyway, so Reb Moshe writes about America. In America, there's no minhag. It's 101 kehilot that have gathered together. It's exactly what Shanik Pitzu Lakan Mikol HaMedinot V'chol Echad Nuheg L'fi HaMakom Shemba Misham. Says in America you can't say there's a minhag. You know who tried to do a minhag America? The Reformed Rabbi Wise. He tried to do a sit, and he was willing to make compromises, and even mentioned Kabbalah, and even mentioned Yerushalayim. He was trying to have one minhag, but it couldn't go. And if it can't go, certainly nowadays with Chassidim coming in and Litvish coming in and Ungarische coming in and the Syrians coming in and every community under the sun winds up in America, so there is no Minhag America. And that's why Reb Moshe says there's no Issur d'oraita of lo tidgo to do. Everyone can do as they see fit. Every community can continue. There's no minhag America. Ungarische remain Ungarische. Litvische remain Litvische. Hasidim remain Hasidim. And more or less, that's what happened in America. The only exception to the rule, and it's people don't even realize it, is Chabad. No, what am I talking about? How many of you are Chabadnikim? They don't wear a shtreimel. Whoever heard of a Hasid not wearing a shtreimel? It's unbelievable. The sixth Rebbe wore a shtreimel. But there's a whole story. The true story is probably a mixture that, there was a bit of fight over the succession to the sixth Rebbe. And the Rebbetzin who survived wanted the oldest son-in-law. And she refused when the Chassidim insisted, because there was 1 year of bit of machlokes. And Chassidim insisted the youngest son-in-law, Reb Menachem Mendel, become Rebbe. She refused to give him the father-in-law's shtreimel, which would have been a symbol of leadership. So he said, "Ebezei daf minish, that if I don't have to, you don't need." And I think in his mind it was much deeper. In my humble opinion, he understood Chassidus is wonderful, beautiful. But to make people wear a shtreimel in Dallas, Texas, is a little bit difficult. Get rid of the shtreimel, and it'll be a lot easier. And to quote Rakefet, the hat that the Rebbe wore in 51, became the new Strymon. There's a hat maker, tell me, in Italy. It's the only one in the world. There are two places that still have that, what would they call it? What they put a hat on, the block. I don't know what the technical word is, but it's like a block on which you form the hat. They're the only ones that can make the Chabad shape, because that star went out long ago with the Mafia. It went out long ago with the Godfather. But the Rebbe wore it, every chassid. So you see, you have every minig in America. Ah, if this is the case that the woman married a man who insists that she shouldn't cut off her hair, marriage is mimakum lemakum, ein daita larza, and this is his minhag, and shalom bayit, you have to take it. But then Reb Moshe goes further. And here I have to tell you, this is the godlet of Reb Moshe. Fabulous. If you know Rabban Lichtenstein, I understand Ketav just put out another volume of a collection of his essays. So I read a bit of a review, and they're writing that the first essay is about sex and marriage, and how a godly Israel can write about it. Rabbanu Shalom, if Gedoli Israel, the Torah writes about sex and marriage. If my memory is correct, it's right in the first parsha of the Torah. Ken yazovisha tavivimo v'davak b'ishto v'hayu lebasar echad. Wow, that's pretty explicit language. Gentlemen, how many shurim did I give? Marriage, husband, wife. Reb Moshe here raises a very delicate problem. In our world today, the Baal Tshuva syndrome, this problem comes up time and again. We're suffering from it. Reb Moshe raises it right here. Hey, wait a minute. Is this man decent? Is he upright? What's with him? You're making your wife break with her custom. She can't shave off her hair. She has to cover it with a tichel. You're a Vulgate. You're a sex predator. Follow me? What's going on in the world today? Women's first names. I showed my wife. I got some Haredi papers. Chinam Ein Kesef on Friday. Got to know where to go. They give them out. It's amazing. Interesting. Big papers. Interesting. No first name. It's beyond words. I spoke about it at the Great Synagogue, if you recall. Spoke about it loud and clear. So, the man's a maneuver. Absolutely not. A woman, you have a responsibility to your husband not to let yourself look bad. Disheveled, not attractive. And let me tell you something in parentheses. An incident that happened in Michalah 40 years ago. There was a book put out by Sonsino Press on marriage. And one time, one of the leading figures in Michalah, you know, with this right-wing mentality, B'nai Akiva was terrible. Everyone's doing tshuva to get through. You're only from because of B'nai Akiva. You're only here in Israel because of it. Oh, no. I don't fall for that. I can tell you the biggest scandal that ever happened that I know of happened in Michalah with an ex-B'nai Akiva who hit chazek. Guy should be thrown into jail with katsav. They should share a cell together and they can learn together. Oh, God. Chilul Hashem. 5-page investigative reporting in Yediyot 2 years ago. Don't ask. Anyway, so he shows me this Sonsino book, an article on marriage, terrible. What was terrible? The article makes the point to a woman that you have to keep yourself attractive. And it quotes Gemara's, Reb Moshe quotes right here, A man is a man. He has a sexual instinct. Thank God he has the sex. If he wouldn't have to say, I showed you the sources years ago. I went through the Gemara in Sanhedrin, the Gemara in Yoma, and the Medrash Rabbah. Why should anyone marry? What do you need to marry today? Self-sufficient. What's the big deal today? Freezer, microwave, washing machine. Who needs kids? The pain in the neck. My mother-in-law used to say, whatever you put into kids, they kick you in, you know, in the kazoo afterwards, no matter what. Yeah, all right, it's true. None of us are ever good enough for our parents. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, could you imagine? His mother-in-law didn't accept him. Okay. Baruch Hashem, my mother-in-law also felt I wasn't good enough for a princess. But Baruch Hashem, later in life, she made her peace with me. But I also, you know, I was stupid. I was a kid. You know, she once served me a fish, and I made a comment: "It's not meat." Like my grandchildren say to me, "If it's not a meat meal, it's not a meal." Today, you catch me eating meat? Come on, fish is what counts. Gentlemen, is he a maneuver? Rav Moshe says absolutely not, and he quotes the Gemara about a sota. By and Yefatoha, what do? You, the Yefatoha, she's required to cut her hair. And the Gemara in Yevamot, Daf Mem Chet, explains, you're learning Yevamot, why do you require a Yefatoha to cut her hair? Kedei l'shelo, you want her l'navel et atzma. You don't want her to be attractive. You don't want the Jew to fall for this shiksa. You don't want the Jew to fall for this beautiful non-Jewish woman. Cut her hair off. It's required halachically. Wow. You want the man to have a wife who's not attractive? And then Rav Moshe says, believe me, I couldn't write this, but Rav Moshe writes it, and he says just the opposite. The better the woman looks, the more she takes care of her hair. Rav Moshe writes, "Gam ika geder v'siyag le'idach kisa, kidei shelo titganeh alav v'lo litein einav be'isha acheret." Rav Moshe writes that if she does look attractive, it works for the good of Torah, because the man will not look at other women. No? So Rakefet will say, how can you be chayshesh? Men will look at other women? Rav Moshe writes, we see Chazal, Paul Belt Chaside Olam, Kahadi Abba Chilkia, Baba Ray, the Choni Hamagil, the Sukhian Tainas, Dafkaf Gimel, Shehikpit.